Welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 20th, 2019. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are novelists Stephen Rowley and Abby Jeanney. First up is Stephen Rowley. Stephen is the best-selling author of Lily and the Octopus and The Editor, which will be the focus of our talk today. His work has been published in 19 languages. He's worked as a freelance writer, newspaper columnist, and screenwriter. He's originally from Portland, Maine, graduate of Emerson College, resides in L.A. And as I said, we're here today to talk about The Editor, published by Putnam, I believe. Yeah, Putnam. Hey, Stephen.
Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You know, I love this book, and I would just love to hear how it came about.
Yeah, to sort of understand The Editor, which sort of the elevator pitch for it is a young writer in early 1990s New York, armed with a sort of candidly autobiographical novel, discovers that there's a publisher, in this case Doubleday, interested in publishing his work. And when he goes in to meet with him for the first time, he discovers that his editor, or the editor interested, is none other than Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, who worked as an editor at Doubleday for about 15 years. And then it's sort of the unexpected friendship that their relationship takes. But you know, the inspiration for it was stemmed from my first novel, Lily and the Octopus, which was sort of a autobiographical fiction in itself. So I was inspired to write about, you know, when I wrote Lily, it was I was sort of deeply honest, very candid about myself and others, and it was a small, strange little book that I thought originally that I might self-publish, and it got into the hands of Simon & Schuster and became a much bigger deal than I ever imagined it. It sort of snowballed out of my control, and while on the whole it was a positive experience, you know, I said some things in it that, you know, I might have reconsidered had I known it would be out there in the world in a major way. So I wanted to write about a character who had a sort of similar autobiographical novel under his, you know, wing, and what might happen to him if in the same sort of circumstances, if it got sort of out of control or bigger than he imagined it. And in this case, he grew up Irish Catholic, and there are some family secrets in the novel that I don't think his family is that pleased about, that Mrs. Onassis, someone that they long admired, now is privy to these secrets. So, you know, the inspiration really stemmed from writing that first book.
So why Jackie O?
You know, she's an enduring figure now, I think, more than ever. It's sort of interesting. There's a real civility and a class to her, which I think at the moment we're sadly lacking from our political discourse. So I think there's something sort of enduring about her legacy. But also, you know, this is a woman who, after the divorce from Onassis, you know, sort of put her head down and went to work. And a lot of people, particularly my age and younger, don't know that she had this really incredible third act to her life. You know, she's known more defined for her relationships with men. And I think the most interesting thing about her is this sort of 15-year career that she had in publishing, where she was out of the shadow of anyone else and really defining her life on her own terms.
Hmm. Yeah, I loved it. And it made me want to, after reading your book, it made me want to read about her, right? I mean, I knew she was an editor during that period, but I, you know, I rarely heard anything about her. And it's really interesting.
She only granted one interview the entire time. You know, she really just wanted the work to speak for itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she was done with the press and done with the limelight.
Yeah. Well, Gosh, there's so much to talk about, and I'm so glad you're going to be with us in May down here in Newport Beach.
Yes,
at the,
I will.
At the speaker series. So whatever we don't get to today, we'll get to then. But
yeah, please come on back.
So during the book, Jackie tells James, who's writing this autobiographical novel, mm-hmm. that the trouble with autobiographical novels is that the book is over, but you have to keep on living. And I thought that was such a great line.
Yeah. It's interesting. You know, for a book needs a tidy ending often, you know, or certainly if not a tidy one, then the story stops at a certain point. But if you're basing your story on yourself, your life continues on. And often things aren't wrapped up as neatly. And there are going to be continued threads to sort of pick at, and additional things to learn, and additional layers to uncover. And the work doesn't stop just because the book is, just because the writing is done.
Yeah. And she also says, I think before that, she says something like, you have to follow the narrative wherever it might go, which, you know, mm-hmm. he's having some trouble with. But I'm curious if this is how you write. Do you know where you're going? Did you have an end in mind when you started writing? Did you have to get that clear in your head where it was going to end up?
I often have a sort of vague sense of an ending. I don't ever know the middle, which sometimes gets me in trouble and sometimes not. But I'm not, I don't work, I know many writers do, who are sort of avid outliners and really have so much nailed down before they start. And the way I work is I like to surprise myself sometimes. And I need maybe a sense of a destination, but the journey needs to reveal itself, or I get a little bit bored. I think I often am flying a little bit blind. Hmm. But that gives me room to build on things that I might not have planned on if I had outlined it so strictly.
Yeah. Well, how did you decide on the present tense, first person present tense?
I wrote my first book that way, and there's a real intimacy to it that I think is hard to replicate from third person. I'm working on something new right now in the third person, and it has its own set of challenges and rewards. But the first person, one thing I heard over and over about Lily is that people had responded to the voice in it, and I sort of wanted to carry that over. I think if there's any sort of trademark to my work, it's an interesting voice, an emotional intimacy, and maybe a little bit of a surprise. With all due respects to Mrs. Onassis, she was sort of my octopus for this. Mm-hmm. and Lily, I threw in an octopus at one point because what I was writing about was attachment and how difficult it can be to let go. And there was something about that metaphor that made a certain amount of sense, And in this story, in the editor, I was looking for a way to write again about something that happened to me. The editor is less autobiographical, but it did sort of start from an autobiographical place, a jumping off point. But I needed that sort of additional element to make it a full, well-rounded story that would be interesting to readers. So, enter Mrs. Onassis. And so I think sort of an unexpected element is sort of a third element to my
So do you think this current book in the third person, is there a chance you might recast it in the first?
There's always a chance. There's always a chance. We'll see.
Well, I would love to hear you read from the editor.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Do you have a particular suggestion, or?
You know, I always think it's great to start at the beginning, but, you know, up to you. I mean, and when I'm talking about the beginning here, I'm talking about dreams. I don't know what page it is. I have the arc, so,
Yeah, page five. Yeah, so this is really the first. The book opens with a slight excerpt of the book within a book. Mm-hmm. We'll start with the actual action of the story.
Okay.
And cut me off if this becomes too much. She moves quickly and with purpose, threading the tight corridor between a hedge maze of cubicles and the string of office doors. Her stride is serious. I have 1,000 questions, but the snap to her step suggests I select only one. Maybe two. No, one. I try to take everything in to remember the details. I'm going to want to recount them later, to relive this in my head. But we're moving so fast. I see paper, lots of paper, and push pins, I think colorful ones, tacked directly into cubicle walls, holding calendars, schedules, memos, and important lists. More paper in place. Marketing standees announce titles as coming soon, and a parade of book covers framed like art hang evenly spaced on the walls between door frames, following me down the hall as if I'm viewing them through a zoetrope. I'm sorry, where are we going? And just like that, my one question wasted. And I hate that I apologize. I have been invited here, and I need to act like I belong before they figure out that I'm the wrong guy, an imposter, a dupe. Without looking back, she says, conference room, end of the hall, and then with barely a pause, would you like some water, James? The sound of my name startles me. Hers is Lila. She told me by the bank of elevators where we were introduced. My agent's assistant told me it was Lisa, but that's typical Donna. Thank goodness Lila introduced herself before I had a chance to call her by the wrong name. That would have really started things off on the wrong foot. Lila has blonde hair, but not so blonde that you can't take her seriously. I really like her shoes. No water, thank you. I can't imagine walking this fast with a glass of water and not sloshing it everywhere, on my sleeve or, heaven forbid, down the front of my pants. I'm sorry I was late. Another apology, but this one is warranted. You were 5 minutes early. Was I? I'm usually 10 minutes early, so in that sense I was late. Lila ushers me inside the last room at the end of the hall. Here we are, conference room. She stares at me, and for the first time I notice her clothes are impeccably tailored. She's serious for a beige girl. That's what I've heard people call a lot of young women in publishing. I'm not fond of the term. It reeks of unnecessary sexism. They're called that, beige girls, because they wear an understated monotones and sweaters to match. But this girl, woman, is a different animal, power beige, like a cafe au lait color or camel or a crew. It's nice, I say about the conference room, which is stupid. It makes me sound impressed, like I've never seen such a room before. And of course I have. I've worked at pretty much every office in Midtown in a never-ending string of toxic, depressing, temporary jobs. This conference room is exactly like any other conference room, with a bulletin board, a whiteboard, a phone in the center of a long table. At least I think it's a phone. It looks somewhat like a light-up game I had as a child, and a set of dry erase markers. It serves a purpose. Her enthusiasm is considerably less than mine. Yes, conferencing. For some reason, I try to sell her on it. It has everything, even a window. Then, as an afterthought, anyone ever jumped? Out the window? She is appalled. I can tell. She tucks her hair back behind an ear while pursing her lips. It's just, I can imagine these meetings getting a little, I know I'm feeling fraught. Power Beige is just staring at me. I'm sorry, I cringe. My third apology inside 2 minutes. You're not interested in my twaddle. For the first time in our incredibly brief relationship, she perks up. I am interested if you're going to jump out the window. I promise I'm not going to jump out the window. She exhales. Disappointed? Perhaps. Why don't you just have a seat then? We've officially run out of things to say. Silence, which I abhor. I pull a chair back from the table and start to sit and then stop. There's a loud ringing in my ears similar to the one I would get as a kid after swimming endless summer hours in Lake George. I always thought I'd be more of a pills person. More twaddle? There was the vaguest hint of a smile. She's joking with me, letting me know to relax. No, it's just, I don't like it when other people have to clean up my messes. Talk of suicide has gone on so long, it may be professional suicide. To change the subject, I steer us towards business. So, my manuscript, you've read it? I have. I replay that last bit in my head. It doesn't sit right. Not that I think my manuscript is one of my messes. I just wanted that to be clear. It was clear. Lila picks up a dry erase marker from the table and sets it on the lip of the whiteboard. In doing this, she softens slightly. And even if it wasn't, that's an editor's job sometimes, to clean up. And you're interested in becoming my editor? You ask a lot of questions. It's nerves, I guess. I make a motion with my hands like I'm vomiting words. Lila grabs the corner wastebasket and holds it out for me. She smiles again, this time more broadly. I decide I like her. She has the ability to play along. No, she responds. Oh, I can feel the heat in my cheeks. You're here to meet with someone else. Oh, my gosh, I'm sorry. I was told by my agent's assistant to ask for Lila. Well, she said Lisa, but she can't read her own handwriting. I'm going to have real words with Donna for putting me through this predicament. James, it's okay. I set up the meeting for you with this editor. And he liked it? The editor I'll be meeting with? She. Sorry. Apology number 4. I wince. This must be some sort of record. Take a deep breath. We're not really in the business of calling writers in to personally tell them how much we didn't like their work. A wave of relief. No, I don't suppose that's the best use of anyone's time. It's easier to do that in a letter, she says. Well, I've received plenty of those, I say before realizing how unvarnished the truth sounds. Well, not plenty, a normal amount. Lila. I use her name as punctuation, unsure if it sounds like an exclamation point or a period. She pulls the chair out farther and pats the back of it. It won't be long now, if you'd like to have a seat. Mm. I sit. Should we pause there?
Yeah, let's pause there. Let's pause there because, you know, we know who comes in next.
Yeah, exactly. We're getting ready for a big entrance.
I love this beginning. And listening to you read, I was curious if you read your work as you're writing.
I do sometimes. Do read it out loud, which is very interesting. I'm very lucky to have the actor Michael Urie, who's read the audiobook for Lily and the Octopus, is back to read the audiobook for the editor, because I just think he's such a talent. But it is interesting then handing the work over to hear someone else read it out loud, because I hear it for so long in a very specific way in my head, and that comes from, yeah, sometimes reading aloud as I work.
Hmm. And there's so many great curtain lines at the ends of chapters that just, you know, make the reader turn the page. And I wondered if you learned this from screenwriting.
It's tough sometimes because curtain lines are really difficult because you do sometimes want to wrap up a chapter, but I'm always conscious about wrapping it up too neatly. You know, you never want an excuse for a reader to put your book down. You know, you do want them to be like, oh, no, I have to start the next chapter right now. And I do. I think that comes a little bit. You know, my background was in screenwriting before I got into writing novels. And I'm very fortunate to say that the film rights for the editor have been picked up by Fox 2000, and I'm currently working on the screenplay for the editor.
Mm.
But which has been fun because casting Jackie has become sort of a fun parlor game amongst my my friends. I do. There's something about screenwriting that, yeah, one scene really needs to roll into the next without as much time to pause, I think, as oftentimes you're allowed in a novel.
Hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We have a few minutes left with Stephen Rowley. His book is The Editor, published by Putnam. Can you tell the story, sort of a collapsed story, about Lily and the Octopus, how it was acquired? Because I found it just really actually inspiring that you had, I think, submitted to, I don't know, 30 agents or something.
Yeah,
and finally,
yeah,
a book editor, somebody you worked with, to help you get it in shape to self-publish, put you on to an editor at,
yeah,
Simon & Schuster?
That's exactly right. You know, I knew from the outset. So Lily was a dog that I had from puppyhood into old age, and she passed away of a brain tumor, I think, in 2013. And, like, I was not prepared for to be sort of sidelined by grief. I intellectually understood dogs don't live as long as we do. I thought I had sort of a grasp on what was coming. But she was a constant companion for me, for a very long time. And writing is a very solitary occupation. And I didn't realize how much I'd come to depend on her company. And then when she passed, I sat down to do what writers do, which is sort of write to understand what we're feeling and what we're going through. And I did write, this story, and then an octopus entered the picture, as I mentioned. And when I finished, I knew this was a very weird novel about a man who thinks there's an octopus stuck to his dog's head, you know, which stood in sort of for the brain tumor. But, you know, it's a weird little book. I tried pitching it originally as a cross between Joan Didion's Year of Magical Thinking and Moby Dick.
That's great.
Which apparently went over like a lead balloon. You know, I reached out to agents. I got no, you know, if you call, if you want to hear crickets on the other end of the phone, you know, pick up and call people and ask if they want to read a book about a dog with an octopus on their head. But I couldn't get anywhere, you know, with trying to get this published. So indeed, I was going to self-publish, and it was wisely suggested to me that I self-publishing is a great option for writers, but it does run the gamut in terms of what's out there. But to hire a freelance editor and get this in as professional shape as possible. And I did that, and through working with a freelance editor who I found in New York, she was able to get it into Simon & Schuster sort of through a back door. I still had no publishing agent at the time. Simon & Schuster agreed to read it. I still didn't think anything would come from it. I was moving ahead full steam with self-publishing plans. But I did get a call from Simon & Schuster a few days later saying that they were very interested in publishing this and that I need to get an agent. When you have an offer for publication, it's much easier to get an agent. You can kind of choose.
Yeah, especially at Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, exactly.
That's great. That's a great story. I like that.
Yeah, and I'm old enough, you know, and I've been around long enough to know that that's not how it happens. That was a bit of sort of magical, you know, I don't necessarily believe that, you know, Lily was up there pulling the strings, but there is some sort of magic that happens surrounding that book, and I'm still not sure how to explain it.
Yeah, and also, you know, when you work hard on something, sometimes the universe meets you, right?
Yeah, it does. It does. If you believe in something. Now, I could have taken all these rejections and sort of thought, oh, there's something wrong with my book and I need to change it. But I had a real vision for it. And it turns out what I needed to change was not the book itself, but learning how to talk about the book, right? Mm. You know, it's not really a book about a dog and an octopus. It's about, you know, a man who's stuck in his life and how the obstacles that we see in our way are, if not outright imagined, sometimes greatly exaggerated. Mm. And it's learning to get unstuck when life seems overwhelming. Yeah. And that's a more sort of universal pitch than, hey, you know, here's the dog and an octopus.
Well, I must read it before you come down in May. And it, you know, so much more to talk about. And I'm just so happy to have you on for this book. Loved it. And yeah, I wish you the best of luck with this.
Thank you very much. I'm thrilled. This book comes out April. The editor comes out April 2nd. So we're about a week and a half away,
yeah,
or 2 weeks away. And I'm thrilled to share it with readers. I'm very excited.
Fun times. Will you be at the LA Times Festival of Books?
I will not this year because I'll be on tour across the country. Most of April I'll be traveling across the country. And the dates for appearances are on my website, stephenrowley.com.
Excellent. We'll see you in May. And thanks for being here, Stephen.
Terrific. I look forward to it. And thank you.
You're welcome. That was Stephen Rowley. His book's The Editor. And if you want to know more, go to my website, penonfire.com. When we return, we should have Abby Jenny with us, so don't go anywhere. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. We are back with Abby Jenny. She's the Chicago-based author of The Lightkeepers, winner of the 2016 Barnes & Noble Discover Award and the inaugural Chicago Review of Books Award, and The Last Animal, an Indies Introduced Debut Writer selection and finalist for the Orion Book Award. Jenny is a graduate of the Iowa Writers Workshop, a recipient of the Iowa Fellowship, and a core faculty member at Story Studio Chicago. Her latest novel is The Wildlands. It was named one of the best books of 2018 by Kirkus, Real Simple, and BuzzFeed, and it's nominated for this year's Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Hi, Abby.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, of course. Great to have you. I love the Wildlands, and it's great to have a show when you just love both books that are on, and that's often the case, but it's especially the case today. Could you tell us how the book came about?
How the Wildlands came to be?
Yeah.
I was really interested for a long time in the idea of a crime spree. There's something so compelling and, like, in a weird way, maybe very American about the idea of somebody who's just like, I'm going to flout all social mores. I'm going to do whatever I feel like doing. You know, we get captivated by Bonnie and Clyde and, you know, these sort of stories. But I wasn't really interested in the kind of romantic angle. I feel like that's been done. So I began thinking about a sibling connection, about two siblings who were on the road, on the run in this kind of situation. And that was sort of the germinating thing of it. And then, of course, I'm obsessed with nature and animals and the connection between the natural world and human beings. And that's how I came to find Tucker, who is an environmental activist / eco-terrorist. And he, you know, that's, I guess, he began the book for me because he's sort of the driving force behind the plot.
Tucker was such an interesting, complex character. By the end, and without giving the ending away or really the entire plot of the book, by the end of the book, the reader knows that he has to pay for what he's done. But he's such a sympathetic guy that you hope it's not too bad.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that because that was my hope. I feel like I wanted to write in Tucker one of those sort of antagonists-ish. I don't know if he's really the antagonist. Anyway, someone who the reader understands where he's coming from, right? We see his point of view to a certain extent, and then he takes it too far. And, you know, a lot of his ideas I sympathize with. I'm not going to go blow up a building, as Tucker does in the book, but, you know, I kind of see his point about animal rights and what's happening to the world. And so, yeah, so I'm glad to hear that you had the same feel about him.
Yeah, I thought he was great. And I'm curious why you chose Cora and Darlene as point of view characters. And the second part of that question is why Cora in the first person and why Darlene in the third?
Do you mean Cora and Darlene as opposed to Tucker as a point of view character, or why them generally?
Yeah, why them generally?
Well, I knew from the very beginning, I knew that Cora was going to be one of the narrators. As soon as I sort of created the character of Tucker, I was seeing him through Cora's eyes. And so I knew that she would have this unique perspective on him. You know, she's only 9 when the book begins. Tucker is her older brother. He's in his 20s. He's been gone for a while. He's a sort of mythical, giant, manipulative, charismatic whirlwind. And, you know, so I could see him through her eyes, and in that way I began to know her. And I felt I think I was a lot like Cora when I was a kid. I was, you know, a little wild. I spent hours and hours outside catching spiders with my bare hands. And I was one of those sort of spooky kids who sometimes knew a little bit more than I was supposed to. And I think that's why I wrote her in the first person, is because I feel very close to her. But writing a whole novel from the point of view of a 9-year-old is a tricky proposition, because, you know, they don't know what they know, and they are seeing things with sort of that malleable mind of a child. So I knew I wanted an adult as well. I didn't want to write from Tucker's point of view. I feel like he's kind of the force of the book rather than the point of view of the book. And so I came to Darlene, who I just adore. Darlene, you know, she's so strong and so empathetic, and she sort of is holding the whole world together. And I'm not like that. So I wrote her in the third person because I felt a little bit distant from the way that she interacts with the world, and also to differentiate her voice from Cora's to a certain extent. But yeah, I wanted that sort of adult, clear-headed mind, and that was Darlene.
Mm. Was the tornado always at the beginning? Was that always the first chapter?
Excuse me. Yes, the tornado, definitely. I like the idea of starting a book with something as, you know, it starts with a tornado, and then I hope that it sort of never slows down. I want it to move that speed the whole time.
Hmm. And the ending, we have to talk about the ending. Without talking about the ending specifically,
right,
it is one of the best endings ever, because you know by the end that Tucker has to get it. He has to be nailed for what he's done. And yet it's it was such a surprising ending, and yet it made so much sense in terms of, you know, the entire book, in terms of how it would happen. So I don't know if you can talk about how you came to that ending, if there were other endings, and then, you know, you happened upon this, or were you headed toward this one all the time? Did you know from the start that this is how the book would end?
Oh, that's a great question. I always have a sense when I'm writing a novel of vaguely where I'm going, and I sort of knew what Tucker's ultimate fate was going to be. Again, I'm sort of speaking in code, so not to give too much away. But I didn't know the right way for him to find it, to come into that final thing that happens to him. So I tried a few different ways, and working with my editor, Dan Smetenka, at Counterpoint, he really helped me fine-tune it and get it to the exact right thing. And so I'm just so glad to hear that it worked for you, because I love that ending. It's intense, but it felt exactly right when I was done writing it.
Yeah,
working with an editor is—it's so wonderful.
Yeah, and Dan's great. You're so lucky to have worked with him. But you know, it's like the ending. As I was reading, I was thinking, how's this going to wrap up? And probably the more traditional, cliched way of ending it would be for the police to get him, right? But that's not what happens. And that's one reason it was so perfect, because it was just such a part of the book. I think everybody should read this book and examine the ending and and come up with something as equally wonderful.
I agree with you. Everyone should read this book.
So talk a little bit about sort of how you stay organized. I mean, in terms of novel, you've written a few. How do you keep it all together? Do you organize online? Do you use a program like Scrivener? Do you have paper everywhere in your office? How do you do that?
Well, the secret for me is that I have, this is where all of my intelligence is in writing novels. So I can kind of, when I'm in the middle of the writing process, I can hold the entire novel in my head. And I remember once I had a particular paragraph that I'd written, and I was trying to find the right place to put it in the book. And so I was out and about, it didn't have my document in front of me. And I was able to kind of scan through the entire document in my head to find where the paragraph should go, chapter by chapter. And so for me, I don't use a program called Scrivener, although I've heard really good things from other writers. I don't have paper all over everything. I just sort of hold it all in my head. Which is, really wonderful, and also makes me really, like, every other part of my life is kind of secondary to the book while I'm in the process of writing it, because I don't have a lot of room for other things. So I do kind of a lot of walking around my house going, why am I in here? What did I come in this room for? Because I can't remember that, but I remember exactly where, what thing I need to fix on the sentence on page 532. That's my process. It's very weird. It's a... It takes a lot of my brain power to do it, but it's what I love. And I kind of, and by the end of writing the book, I'm like living 90% of the time in that world, because so much of my brain is caught up in it.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Abby Jeanney. Her book is The Wildlands, published by Counterpoint. So then tell us a little bit about process then. I mean, do you barrel through the first draft? Do you work on it bit by bit, and by the end you have a draft that maybe you go over once? I mean, how does that work for you?
That's another great question. For both of the novels that I've written and the one that I'm thinking about beginning now, I think about the book for years before I write it. And I think that's part of why I hold it all in my head in that way, is that I, literally for years I'll be walking around sort of going, oh, for the third book that I want to write in the series that I have lined up in my head of novels that I'm going to write, I need to make sure to make this thing happen. So I always have several books sort of cooking on back burners in my mind. And for The Light Keepers, I thought about The Light Keepers for about 10 years, and then I wrote the first draft in about 9 months. And it was similar with The Wildlands. I had it in my head, and I was moving all the pieces around and getting to know the characters and thinking about the themes and doing research about animal rights and about the Anthropocene mass extinction, which is, sort of what drives Tucker. And then when I began to write, I had so much of it already established in my head that, the first draft happened really fast. But yeah, people will sometimes say, how long did it take you to write the book? And I'm sort of like, well, either 10 years or 1 year. Mm-hmm. I don't really know how to answer that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes sense. Sometimes we don't let our ideas percolate long enough, I think. And then we spend years revising, right?
So yeah, I guess you spend the years either way.
Yeah.
I spend them before I create it, and other people do it after.
Mm. And the setting is so visceral and is almost really another character. And I read that you did not grow up in the South and tornado country, and that you don't like to travel. So I don't know if those things are true, but maybe
absolutely true.
Talk about how you get setting. You know, how you nailed the setting so well.
First of all, thank you. I'm so glad to hear that. My husband is an Okie, and so I have been to Oklahoma a number of times to visit his family. And the first time I went there, I was like, this place is fascinating. I need to learn everything. I need to write about it. But I don't love to travel. I love to be in my house, you know, with all of my things that I know about and my garden. And, you know, I'm very rooted in my spot. You know, I write in the same window every day. And if I have a different window to write in, I'm just completely thrown. But I love to, you know, my books often, and I think short stories too, they start with setting. That's one of the first things that I know about is where I want to set it. And I love to write about places that I haven't been. And I love to do a lot of research so that I have a good sense of what that place is like. And then I kind of create the rest of it by sort of creating my own imaginary version of that place. So in The Lake Keepers, you know, it's set on the Farallon Islands, which is a real island chain in California, and I've never been there. But I did so much research, and then I sort of imagined this fictional version of it that I could inhabit. And I think I did, you know, I feel like I did the same thing in the Wildlands, which is, I've been to Oklahoma, I know about Oklahoma, but the Oklahoma in the book is a little bit more magical and a little more heightened. And that was sort of the fictional version that I could live in while I was writing it. And it's that sort of extra bit of creating it that makes it seem, I don't know. Like, I remember when I finished writing The Wildlands, I thought, oh, I can never go to Oklahoma again now. And, you know, that's not true. I can go to the real Oklahoma. But the one that I wrote about was so vivid to me. And it's sort of this other place. And the same thing was true when I wrote The Light Keepers. I remember finishing that book and thinking, oh, I can never go to the islands again. So it's, you know, it's this. It's a real place, but it's also a heightened place. It's also a fictional place.
Right, right. Well, now I must read The Light Keepers. I haven't read that one yet, so I'm going to find that one. Were there any surprises in writing The Wildlands? Did anything happen as you were writing or getting toward the end that was a major surprise to you?
I think that always happens. And I think that's part of the danger of the way that I write. You know, I write, I think, for so long before I write, and I make all my, you know, I get all my ducks in a row. And sometimes when you write that way, you're not as open to spontaneity as you could be. So I've learned to be careful about locking myself into a sequence of events in the book and saying it has to be this way, because the book will surprise you. You know, the characters will do things you didn't expect, or things will happen that you know, you didn't plan for. And if you're open to that, the book can take you to really interesting places. I think for The Wildlands, the thing that surprised me the most was the epilogue, which, again, I don't want to give too much away, but that was the thing that took me the longest to figure out exactly where the epilogue should be, who it should be about, how it should happen. And I got to say, I love the epilogue. I'm so pleased with it. And I, you know, it just brings me so much joy. And that was something that it took, you know, every particle of me and Dan Smetanka, my editor, working together to figure out exactly the right note to end on. So I'm really, I didn't see that coming, but I'm so glad that it ended the way that it did.
Yeah, I love the epilogue, too. I love everything about this book.
Yay!
are there any novels that have influenced you that maybe you read a long time ago, not so long ago, that kind of pointed you toward the future writing of this?
That's interesting. I read when I was little, and when I was, you know, a formative person, I read constantly. I read novels. You know, I would read while I was brushing my teeth. I would read while I was walking upstairs, made my mom crazy. And then when I began writing fiction as an adult and publishing, I stopped reading fiction because I found that it kind of bled into my own work in ways that were counterproductive. And so I began reading mostly nonfiction, which is kind of a, you know, it's a loss. And I miss reading fiction. I loved sort of going into someone else's imaginary world. But I find that it kind of impinges on my own imaginary worlds. But some of the books I loved when I was little, I think I loved books about people who had ferocious passions that drove them, because I think that's how I tend to find my own characters, is by knowing what they care about. Like, I know about Tucker because I know about animal rights and the Anthropocene mass extinction and what's happening to the world. And so each character I kind of locate that way. And so I love books about people who are passionate, who are fascinated by things. And I also, in terms of nonfiction, which is what, again, most of what I read, I just love books that give me a new idea about how the world works. I feel like we're all constantly mapping the world to find out what it is. And so every time, I was just reading The Order of Time, which is a very strange book about how time doesn't exist. And I was like, oh, maybe time doesn't exist. it changes the way you see your life. So I don't know if you wanted specifics or just sort of generally the way books have influenced me. Or
specifics are fine too. And I've never heard of that one, The Order of Time. That's really interesting.
Well, I was listening to the audiobook, actually. It's read by Benedict Cumberbatch. So I recommend it because you get to listen to Benedict Cumberbatch. in terms of the books that I love, I loved Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell by Susanna Clarke, which is, about the sort of the magic in England, and the passion of people who are obsessed with magic. And again, it's that kind of fictional heightened version of a real place, which I really respond to. I remember one of the books I loved most is Three Junes by Julia Glass, which the structure of that book is completely insane. I don't know how she did it, but that was a book that really taught me that structure is what you make it, and everybody who creates a novel is kind of inventing the form, and everybody's going to find a different way to write their book. And I loved The Time Traveler's Wife by Audrey Niffenegger. It's just, again, like, how did she structure it? Did she have a spreadsheet? I don't know. It's so beautiful and so seamless, but it must have taken so much work. And I'm a very structural writer. I think a lot about structure while I'm writing. So I'm fascinated by books that use it in an interesting and unexpected way.
Well, I was going to ask you, in terms of the structure of The Wildlands, how you break it up into months. The sections are, heralded by months. And how did you come to that?
Well, in writing my first book, so The Lightkeepers was initially, it took place over the course of a year, but it wasn't broken into parts. It was just one big chunk. And when I was working with my editor, he said, why don't we break it up into four seasons? Because that's something that is present in the book, but we could, beef that up. And so then I learned about writing using parts, which makes it easier to write a novel, because novels are really long and it's really hard to build a structure that travels over 450 pages it's just a big proposition. And so when I started writing The Wildlands, I was like, I'm gonna have parts. I'm gonna not just chapters, not just scenes, but also parts. And so as I was thinking about it, I knew it was going to be this sort of brief, intense period of time in these characters' lives. And as soon as I realized that it was going to be about 6 months, I was like, oh, well, that naturally makes sense. So that, then I can do, the month of July, and I can build the structure of things that happen in the month of July. And that's easier than building the things that happen over the entire summer. Mm-hmm. So that was always there at the beginning of just, let's do parts. Parts are great.
I love that. I love that because I think a lot of writers, especially writers who are, maybe primarily short story writers, think of writing a novel as impossible because it's too big. But finding a way to break it down like that, I think, is genius. So, I love that. I love that. Abby, thank you so much for being on the show. I wish we had more time because there's so much more to talk about, as usual.
Yay!
But
this is lovely.
Really did love your book. And I wish you the best of luck with the LA Times Book Prize.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That was Abby Genie. Her book is The Wildlands, and do check it out, especially check out the ending. You got to read that ending. What a great ending, and we're at the ending of today's show. Thank you for listening, and we'll be here next week. So I hope you're back too.